Thank you, Craig. It's great to be with you all today. I appreciate you taking time out of busy schedules to be here. And I know we kind of rushed lunch, but that's the way life is. Our commitment to you is to try to be very good stewards of this time. I learned a lot at a very early age by watching people I greatly admired. And one of those was Ronald Reagan. At age 16, I was a high school coordinator of volunteers for the Ronald Reagan campaign of 1976. It was a brave crusade that went all the way, some of you will remember, to the Republican National Convention. But nonetheless, I got to be around Governor Reagan as he came to the campaign operation. And that was an unforgettable experience, just to kind of sense who he was. It was a campaign of ideas, and he embodied those ideas, and he talked about them all the time. But he had done all that speaking for General Electric through so many years before. And as he said, the formula is very simple. They serve chicken, then I speak. And he said, I have slaughtered millions and millions of chickens so that I could speak. I couldn't help thinking about that today. I also couldn't help thinking about a story that I read in a memoir some time ago, and I've shared it with people. Some of you may have heard me share it before. It's exquisite. It has to do with Prince Philip, who was on a state visit. Prince Philip is not the brightest member of the royal family, and that's kind of what he says himself. He says, "I'm not here for my brains." He is more, it's not really a matter of intelligence, it's a matter of not saying what's on his mind. He has no governor from saying what's on his mind. He famously was there when the Queen was knighting someone who had crossed a South Pacific island in terms of a walk, and I don't know why that earned one a knighthood, but after the Queen had knighted him, he turned to him and said, "Pray tell, how did you avoid being eaten by cannibals?" And just right out in public so everyone could hear, and I think he meant it seriously. He was at a dinner, a state dinner, and he had a choice between the waiter offered him the lamb or the duck. And he was in South Africa, and actually in a sub-Saharan African nation. And he was there on this state visit, and they had already made many blunders. And as the memoir recalls, the waiter turned to Prince Philip and said, "Would you like the lamb or the duck?" And Prince Philip said, "Tell me about the duck." And the waiter looked at him a little cross-eyed and said, "It's like a chicken, but it swims." And I think we've all been there before. It's like a chicken, but it swims. Well, I thank you for sharing chicken with us today, and for sharing your time as well. And I look out in the room and see so many friends. I wish I could say hello individually to you all and tell you how much it means that you're here, but just know that you are welcome. When I was elected president of Southern Seminary in 1993, and by the way, one of the humbling things that now happens in my life is that entering students now, many of them were not born when I was elected president. That's a deeply humbling thing. When I was first elected president, people kept talking about how young I was, and at some point, and I'm not sure exactly when it happened, those comments ceased. I don't hear that anymore. And I was driving along with one of my interns some time ago, who was driving me to a speaking event. We were just talking, and I was getting to know about his family, and he was telling me about his father, who had such a massive influence in his life. I said, "You know, your father's probably not much older than I am." There's this dead silence. He says, "He's younger than you are." Oh, thank you. That helps. That helps. But when I was elected president in 1993, and I was 33 at the time, the search committee came to me. We went through the process, and I was not the most likely candidate when I was 33, but the search committee chose me. And then they told me, after they chose me, between when the search committee chose me and when the board would elect me, they said, "We have arranged a set of psychological tests." Now, that was not good news. Because I had just recently seen the movie What About Bob, and I'll just tell you that I was not looking forward to subjecting myself to that kind of conversation. It turned out it was relatively painless, but the psychologist met with me, and the first question he asked me was, "How badly do you want this job?" Now, as I thought about it, I thought this is a loaded question because I either end up sounding like I don't want the job or I'm Napoleon. How do you, you know, when you consider how a psychologist is considering the appropriate response. And so I just simply told him when he asked me, I said, you know, I think I was created to do this job. I said, I'll be honest, I want to do this job, but more than that, I think I need to. And he's over there scribbling, and I don't know what in the world he's writing. You know, it's just a giant arrow down the page or something. I didn't have any idea. And so in typical psychological testing style, they leave saying, it's been very good to meet you. It's a good conversation. They don't say, hey, by the way, I think you're nuts or you're okay. So I had to wait a couple of days, and the chairman of the search committee called, and he came and said, well, that was good. I said, it was? He said, yes. I said, you know, the most interesting question he asked me, I said, everything seemed loaded on that first question. How badly do you want this job? And I said, I'll be honest, I didn't know how to answer that question. He said, what did you say? I told him. And he said, well, you know, I think the thing that all of us know and have come to know in that search process was you were meant for this job. And your passion for this job, your passion for what it could mean is, I think, what led us to you. What I want to speak about is passion and leadership. Soren Kierkegaard was known as a philosopher as the melancholy Dane, and it was because the Danish philosopher seemed to have kind of a down, negative view of everything. He was doing his philosophy in the time of the Enlightenment and early modernity when he was sensing how much was being lost in the modern age. And so it's not by accident that the one word that seemed to characterize him was melancholy. And from an Orthodox Christian perspective, Kierkegaard is not that helpful. Kierkegaard finally decided that the only way you could know truth was through what he basically invented, which was existentialism. So he's an odd person for me to bring up in this context, except for one reason, and that is, like so many people whose eventual philosophy ends up being wrong, their analysis of reality can start out being right. And Kierkegaard's analysis of reality was very powerful, and it stuck with me throughout my lifetime. He said, especially looking at the Danish church of his time, he said, they go through all the motions. They say all the right things. They seem to know exactly what to do in terms of walking through a service of worship. And yet there's one thing missing. And then he looked at the political class of his day. He said, you know, they seem to be competent. It's not that they're incompetent. They seem to go through the motions. They seem to understand what Parliament is supposed to do. They seem to be adequately intelligent for the task, but there's one thing missing. And then he looked at the business class of his day in Denmark, and he said, clearly, there are businessmen who are building great enterprises, and there are others, most, who are simply just getting the job done. He said, they're not incompetent, and they're not unintelligent, but there's one thing missing. And then he got to the bottom line. He said, the one thing missing is the one thing most needful, and that is passion. He said, looking at these people doing their jobs, going through their everyday lives, he said, the one thing that seems to be missing is the one thing that would matter most. And especially about the Danish church, he said, if all those pastors in the Danish church believed what they were saying, their faces would have to show it. If they actually believed the truths they were helping a congregation to sing, they would sing them in an entirely different way than they're being sung. The one thing most needful is the one thing most absent, and that is passion. When I think about leadership, I think about my own experience, not only as a leader, but first of all, as a follower. And I am reminded of what it was like to be drawn to passion. And I didn't have a vocabulary for that as a kid. I just was drawn to it. My Boy Scout troop leader in South Florida was an associate mission director at NASA when I grew up in South Florida. And let me just tell you, if you're an 11-year-old boy, you don't need a lot of encouragement to be excited. I grew up in the space age. I can still remember there in 1969 where my cousins and I had to rig together in the middle of Central Florida where we were between two television markets. We had to rig together enough aluminum foil to attach to the rabbit ear so that we could see Neil Armstrong put his foot on the moon. And, you know, I can still remember as that Boy Scout, this Boy Scout master, he loomed giant in our lives, but it was because he had such passion about the space program. He would not only do it as a job, it was clearly a sense of calling. And the people in my life who had the greatest impact, from my father to pastors and youth leaders and the people that I observed, the people I was drawn to, was passion. When I look back to the age 16, why in the world as a 16-year-old did I sign on to a presidential campaign as a volunteer? It was because I was drawn to the passion that exuded from Ronald Reagan every time he opened his mouth. He not only believed these things, he believed that his convictions mattered, and he believed that they should be translated into public policy. And he believed that if they were translated into public policy, it would lead to human flourishing and human happiness. And he was happy, excited about sharing that passion at all times. If Kierkegaard's right, and the one thing most needful is the one thing most absent, we got to ask the question, why is it that passion is so absent from so much of contemporary leadership? And by the way, that's using the word leadership in a way that implies that sometimes it happens and we're not sure why. Leaders sometimes lead simply because they have to lead. But the leaders of endurance, the leaders of great influence, the leaders who really matter, the leaders who change lives and change the world, are leaders who are filled with passion. And in that sense, leadership is simply indivisible from passion. But like so many of the most important realities, we often sense passion more than we are able to define it. I want to ask several questions with you today. But number one, what produces passion? You know, where does it come from? When you look at a leader who exudes that kind of passion and is enthusiastic with that kind of passion, where does that come from? My understanding of leadership, and that's why I wrote the book, The Conviction to Lead, is that the only leadership that really matters is leadership that is born in conviction. It's born in truth. It's born in belief. And the distinction I make between mere beliefs and convictions are these. Beliefs are matters of truth that we hold, but convictions are beliefs that hold us. We don't know who we are without them. They're those core beliefs that shape everything we know, everything we do, everything we think. And one of the problems today, by the way, we can just see in terms of doing an autopsy, as Kierkegaard did on the contemporary situation, one of the problems in so many arenas of life today is that the absence of passion betrays the absence of conviction. There simply are no guiding convictions. There are simply assumptions or marketing plans or some kind of short-term plan or mission. There is no great passion that consumes life because there's no great conviction behind it. If passion could be made into a pill, every leader would take it and when they distribute that pill to every member of the organization. But it doesn't work that way. We can't buy passion. We can't just decide to be passionate. You know, it's one of those things I can still remember when my father's approach to a bad attitude was to say, get happy. And I can still remember as a little kid thinking, I'm not sure I can get, I mean, how do you get happy? And it's a little harder to get happy when your father looks at you and goes, get happy. And you're thinking, how's that going to happen? And then all of a sudden you realize at some point, I better get happy or I'm going to be unhappy. And yet, you know how difficult it is to conjure that up. Well, just look at somebody and say, be passionate. That it really doesn't happen. Passion has to come from somewhere, and it has to come from somewhere for some reason. Passion arises out of conviction, and I don't think it can come any other way. Someone once remarked that communism never produced a great work of art. You can recognize Stalinist architecture because it's just ugly. Communism produced only horrifying art, and for a very good reason. Its convictions were itself horrifying. But one of the most interesting things about communism, when you look at the fall and the breakup of the Soviet Union, and there are a lot of those videos that are still up there, and you look at the faces of these guys. For instance, there was a very interesting film that came out not long ago just tracing the trajectories of the last leaders of the Soviet Union. And one of the film clips it showed was all of those leaders, the last three, and they were all together at one time before they all started dying off and then Gorbachev quit. They were all standing on top of that building at Red Square watching one of the great patriotic parades of the Russian army going by. And you just look at the faces and you go, these guys have quit. They looked like the saddest group of human beings on the planet. And there was absolutely no passion in this whatsoever. And, you know, it's interesting that in retrospect, you could see it. You could see the passion waning, and you could see the passion coming. In the Iceland summit meeting between President Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev, the first time they ever met, and Gorbachev was supposed to be, you know, the passionate young leader of the Soviet Union, you know, the rescuer, the last hope of the Soviet Union. And Reagan's supposed to be this, you know, doddering American president in his eighth decade of life. And you may remember that there at Reykjavik, the Gorbachev limousine pulled up. And the Soviet limousine, that giant Zil limousine that they drove, you know, they opened the back door and out pops Gorbachev in a big Russian trench coat, fur collar, and a hat. And it's cold. It was in Iceland in the winter. And then to greet him, walking down the steps, is Ronald Reagan wearing a business suit and a smile in Iceland in the winter. And you just look at it and you realize, okay, there's the difference. Here you got somebody who knows he's on the right side of history when it comes to human liberty and human dignity. And here you've got someone who knows his experiment is done. It's just a matter of negotiating how it's going to be over. But you look at those doddering old men, you look at them standing up there on that building overlooking the Red Army marching, and you realize there's no passion there. And in retrospect, how could there have been? The truth of the Soviet Union was horrifying, not inspiring. It wasn't uplifting. And furthermore, the core convictions upon which the Soviet Union had been built have been disproved by their own experience long before. One of my favorite stories told by Alexander Solzhenitsyn was about the way that the communists just finally faced the fact that it wasn't working, and that it had to do with a man who worked in a wheelbarrow factory. And you may have heard the story. There was a man who was working in a wheelbarrow factory, and every day, for all the years he worked in this Soviet factory, just in order to get by and take care of his family, he tried to steal something from out of the factory every single day. So one day he'd be going out with his wheelbarrow, and he'd have bricks in it. And the commissar would catch him and would say, you know, there you go again, trying to steal, you know, give me the bricks. So he'd take the bricks and he'd go on home. Then the next day he'd try to steal some bolts, and he'd be going out the wheelbarrow with the bolts, and they would stop him. He did this every day for many years until finally he retired. And so the commissar, they've been playing this game going on for 30 years, every single day. And so the commissar finally on the last day says, comrade, why did you do such a foolish thing as to try to steal all those things, knowing it was under my watchful eye? And the man looked at him and said, buddy, I was stealing wheelbarrows. You know, a system with that kind of perverse incentives is a system that is built upon a lie. The convictions simply were proved to be untrue, and the passion simply evaporated, and the Soviet Union fell. Now just look around the business world. The leaders who are most transformative and effective are those who believe most deeply in what they're doing, in the theory of their own business. Steve Jobs really did think that people would be empowered by technology. And it's clear that was his driving sense of vision. That was his passion. He was so passionate about it. One of my favorite stories in Walter Isaacson's book is where when they brought the first iPhone prototype to Steve Jobs, he received it with his eyes closed and simply held it in his hand, running his fingers over all the surfaces to see what it felt like. And he handed it back and says, it doesn't feel right. Bring me another one. Now, he never saw it. He never saw that first prototype with his eyes. He didn't have to. Now, you look at that and you say, that's passion. Henry Ford really believed that the cause of humanity would be greatly advanced by the development of the automobile and by his development of the living wage, the family wage, and by the development of the assembly line. If you're looking for a CEO for an airline, you better seek someone who loves planes, who dreams of airplanes and draws routes in his sleep. The same necessary passion applies to every other arena of leadership. The president of a university better believe in education or it's going to fail. An effective general must truly believe in the disciplined use of force that can establish peace. The head of a hospital better wake up every morning in such a passion that he or she can hardly wait to get to work and see people helped and healed. The same thing's true in church life, of course. All around us are churches that are thriving and churches that are failing. And I would argue that for the most part, the ones that are failing are those that are spent in passion, and they're spent in passion because they've lost conviction. It is a theological failure that leads to a failure in passion that leads to a failure in mission. And on the other hand, when you look at the churches that are thriving and showing the power of Christ and the power of the gospel, it's because they are driven by conviction, those deep biblical convictions about God, Christ, and the gospel. And they're driven with a sense of urgency, believing that heaven and hell are literally in the balance. And they're driven by a concern for people to hear that gospel, and thus that truth gets translated into conviction, it gets translated into passion. And when you look at those churches, it wouldn't be enough if it's merely the preachers or the pastors that possess that passion. Those churches are only thriving because the members of those churches share that passion as well. I want to listen to a preacher who can't wait until Sunday morning comes so he can preach. In any context of leadership, passion arises out of beliefs. For the Christian leader, those convictions have to be drawn from the Bible and have to take the shape of the gospel. Our ultimate conviction is that everything we do is dignified and made important by the fact that we were created for the glory of God. And as we were created for God's glory, this means every one of us has a divine purpose for our existence. Thus, the Christian leader finds passion in the great truths of the Christian faith, and especially centrally in the gospel of Jesus Christ. No one who has truly experienced the transforming and redeeming power of the gospel can think of life, our own life, or any other life, without passion. Leadership arises from this passion and is driven by it. Other leaders may be driven by a passion for cars or technology or empire building. The Christian leader is driven by conviction that frames all of life's meaning, and everything else flows from it. The effective leader sees a problem and then responds with a passion to solve it. That kind of passion comes from the convictions within. The convictions and beliefs are already in place, and the passion is ready to be deployed. Almost like a reflex, the leader finds that plans and strategies and ambitions come into view, not just because of intelligence, because there are more people who have the intelligence than have the passion, but because of the passion. This is the essence of passionate leadership, and the passion, nonetheless, can't stop with the leader. So question two. How does one catch passion? Passionate leaders attract and motivate passionate followers, and together they build passionate organizations, passionate congregations, passionate institutions and movements. A few years ago, I was asked to preach in a church in the middle of a cornfield in Ohio, and I do mean in the middle of a cornfield. You could not see the parking lots from the road because it was all surrounded by cornfield. Now, I had to pass a lot of cattle before I got to the cornfield, before I got to the church. And I walked in, and to be honest, I was expecting maybe 70, 80, maybe 150 people. There were 900 people in this church building. And I simply wondered to myself, how in the world could this happen? People are driving 15 miles out of town to go to this church. And then I experienced the worship. I got to know what this church is all about. This church is all about passion. And here's what's really interesting. There are all kinds of churches in that larger community that aren't reaching the community. That community is being reached by a church in the middle of a cornfield, because it's filled with a Great Commission passion. Passion is contagious like an infection. And it's the kind of infection we hope and pray for. We hope that the kind of passion that is spread by the kind of leadership we want to exercise and emulate is something that gets caught simply sometimes by being in proximity to us. You know, we'd like to think it maybe it's an airborne virus, but it's really not airborne, it's conviction-borne. It's what gets communicated from one heart to another, from one mind to another, from one person to another, because just being in proximity to some leaders, you can't help but be more passionate simply for having been in the room with them, simply for having engaged in a conversation with them or having heard them. Leaders with true compassion transfer that passion to others. It's a contagion that we hope to start and never to stop. Before long, passion takes hold of an entire movement and lasts for the long haul. We want it to be a lasting, raging infection. Third, then, how do we communicate passion? Leaders have to learn to use what the Latin American writer Octavio Paz calls the language of passion. You know, very interesting. He was describing his own approach to writing as he was receiving the Nobel Prize for Literature, and he said, I just try to write out of my passion. He said, if I tried to write anything else, no one would want to read it. But the right author can make you passionate about something you didn't even know you were interested in. A little footnote here, a little book note. I would suggest that you all should read the book that just was released Tuesday. It's entitled Dark Wake by Eric Larson. It's the history of the sinking of the Lusitania. And Eric Larson, as you know, is a very well-known author. But he is an author who knows how to find a story about which he is passionate. And 5 pages into this book that was released Tuesday morning, you are going to resist sleep and anything else in order to continue reading the book. You didn't care about the Lusitania 5 minutes before you picked up the book. Now you feel like you're a part of the story. That's how conviction and passion are communicated. They're communicated with words. Now, there's more to it than that, but they're never communicated without words. Words are how we communicate because God made us as linguistic creatures, verbal creatures. And using words, we deploy the words that will lead to the greatest passion. What does it sound like? The passionate leader speaks the language of morality and purpose. It's not enough that a decision is announced as workable. It has to be right. The leader can't be satisfied that a product is adequate. It has to enhance the life of those who use it. A plan can't be justified with the language of apathetic analysis. It has to be presented with the language of passion and purpose. No one wants to sign on to the adequate. We want to commit our lives to something grand and purposeful, something that's going to change the world. Recent article in the Wall Street Journal indicated that millennials want to work for companies that are out to change the world. And it was really interesting because it's how every company, and the lead example was a computer-based travel agency that was having to say, you join us, you change the world. Now, to be honest, I'm not exactly sure how you change the world through a computer-based travel agency, but it is interesting that even that company knows it's got to translate into changing the world. Dan Dumas and I were in Southern California over the last week. We were in Venice, California, which, as I discovered, is sort of like Berkeley on the Bay. It was an alternative existence. It was definitely a place where Dan and I were old. And it's the kind of place where you have intelligentsia coffee, where it costs you $6 just to get one cup of coffee, which, I can't imagine answering to my father about. But nonetheless, we were there because we wanted to see a little store called Warby Parker. And some of you know that internet company. Well, now they have a store in this community. And Dan had heard about it. We said, let's go see it because people are talking about it. It's kind of the prototype. You know, you go in there and they are passionate about selling glasses. And I mean really passionate about selling glasses. They don't want you to wear their glasses. They want you to be a part of their world. And I didn't need a pair of glasses. I've got plenty of glasses. I walked out of there with a pair of glasses. I'm not even sure exactly how it happened. Dan did too. I mean, we walked in and we walked out, and we both had a pair of glasses. And it's because these people are so passionate about their eyewear. If you dare to go in their store, you're coming out with a pair of glasses. You may have perfect eyes, and you're going to believe that your life will be enhanced with a set of their glasses. That's the way passion works. Somewhere, someone had a passionate idea that got translated into a company, and there are a bunch of young people who, amazingly enough, share that passion. It had to be communicated to them. People are driven and drawn to see a great need, to be passionate about meeting it. When push comes to shove in leadership, and it will, all that will really matter is passion. And where the passion is spent or the passion is absent, no leadership's going to happen. So, then what is the language of passion? Well, the language of passion means that we learn to translate the deepest truths we know into language that proves we not only know them to be true, but these truths have transformed our lives. We learn to speak in the first person of the passions that drive us because of the convictions that undergird our lives. And we make very clear that we believe them not just for ourselves but for others, which is a very interesting thing. Sometimes the leader has to believe for those he or she will lead until they believe themselves. We have to passionately believe for them until they believe. They sometimes ride on that. And the language of leadership and that gets translated into a language of passion. You know, to know me is to know what a looming hero Winston Churchill has been in my life from the time I was 13 years old. And just to hear Churchill speak, I mean, you're talking about a man who was saying many of the same things others were saying them, but he believed them and they weren't sure. They looked at the same things, and he always saw the moral center of the reality and translated that into passion. And when all that stood between the British people and their freedom and Operation Sea Lion and the horrifying plans of Adolf Hitler, all that stood between the British people and doom was the language of Winston Churchill. And the passion he brought to that language and to every single speech, they lived on it. You know, just a few weeks ago, we had the 50th anniversary of Winston Churchill's funeral, and I cited one of my favorite things from Churchill when he spoke about this, because he was credited, in fact, William Manchester famously referred to Churchill in his biography as the last lion. And it's because many people referred to Churchill as the lion, but looking back on the time that he led Britain, especially during the war, he said, "I was not the lion." He said, "Britain was the lion. But it fell my lot," he said, "to voice the roar." And that's Churchill in his essence. The roar is passion. And that kind of passionate leadership matters. Learning to use the language of passion means learning what Mark Twain said in terms of his own writing style is the difference between lightning and a lightning bug. And, you know, we all know when we're reading a lightning bug, and we know when we're reading lightning. And we know when we're hearing a lightning bug, and we know when we're hearing lightning. And, you know, the most amazing thing is that if you are delivering lightning, people be drawn to it. And before long, you'll be hearing lightning from them. If what we really represent is a lightning bug, then all we're going to do is bring a few more lightning bugs. If we speak with lightning, things happen. Soren Kierkegaard said, the one thing most needful is the one thing that's absent. And I think most of us can look around and recognize we know what that looks like. But we turn that around and say, where it isn't absent, where it's present, boy, we know where that is and we're drawn to it. I just want to tell you that I think the question that psychologist asked me was an appropriate question. I'm still not sure what he thought the right answer was. But the reality is, I had a passion to do what they were asking me to do. And I decided the only real way to respond to that question was to say, yeah, I've got that passion. I think this is what I'm supposed to do. Evidently, it didn't scare them off. I don't think that does scare people off. I think people aren't looking for a lightning bug. They're looking for lightning. And I hope the time we spend here today will mean that there's more lightning for the world to see for all the right reasons and for all the right effects. Thank you. Thank you for coming.